Greetings, Sun Sounds listeners, and welcome to the Philosopher Program. This is your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader Candy Lewis, along with her co-host Kitty Bullet Lewis. We begin our program with some daily selections from Science of Mind, Guide for Spiritual Living. The theme for October again has been Glow Up, and the daily selections were written by Ernest Holmes with comments by Jesse Jennings. The creative center. In practice, one views the condition only as a symbol and proceeds at once to change the thought. Maud Allison Latham. As we survey all the conditions surrounding us in our daily living, we need to appraise them differently. First, they're not immovable and unchangeable. Second, we should not let them influence us to a greater extent than we desire to be influenced. At this point, we can again remind ourselves that we should not judge by appearances, but should judge righteously. Look beyond the appearance and rightly determine the cause back of it, that cause which is unseen on the mental and spiritual level. We need to believe in a power greater than any negative experience. We need to walk calmly through life with a complete sense of security based on our certainty that our relationship to God, to Spirit, the universe, cannot be disturbed by any external condition. We turn to the creative center within us, to the creative power of our thought, which is the action of mind in us and as us, and at this point accept new ideas, building them into sound patterns of thought, knowing that the way they appear in our experience will make use of only the best possible materials consistent with the pattern for their construction. This was from A New Design for Living in 1959, page 108. Material life is in such constant change that perceiving any part of it has been described as taking a snapshot of a waterfall. But life is a journey, and not just for the human individual. Everything that creeps or flies is headed on some errand. Nature goes about its cycles of bloom to decay, to bloom again, largely without our interference. In this reading, we're reminded to suspend the kind of critical judgment that gets us more emotionally involved in a problem than its answer. Affirmation. The divine circulates through me automatically, freely. Every atom of my being is animated by its action. Cosmic order. In nature, we constantly sense a mystical power. We see the bending trees and say the wind is air in motion. But what is the power back of this moving air? Marjorie Meyer. There's a center of everything. A divine pattern that molds spiritual substance into definite form. In moments of confusion, we may temporarily lose sight of this pattern and be let down, so to speak, into the world of confusion, our heaven momentarily lost. To regain this lost paradise, we must resolutely turn from everything that denies the divine presence at the center of our being. Therefore, I know the cosmic order is life, wholeness, and peace. I now affirm that the divine pattern of perfection, which must be held in the mind of God, of Spirit, of the universe, is the final, only real and present truth about me. There is nothing in my mind that resists the incarnation of this divine pattern as what I am. My awareness turns to the prototype of me in the mind of God, the God life within me, and the Spirit that surrounds me. This is the divine pattern of my life. The Spirit of God passes through me into expression and to fulfillment. Every legitimate desire is fulfilled, and my entire experience overruns with the goodness of life. I accept this goodness in its entirety. God, Spirit, the universe, knows me only as a perfect idea, and that perfection I now manifest. Spiritual Awareness, 1972, pages 36 through 37. Holmes speaks of divine patterns rather than divine plans. A plan sounds externally imposed, as if God had a specific agenda for each of our lives. If that were true, we wouldn't need to live them out. All would be accomplished regardless. Instead, a patterning intelligence accepts our heart's desires and acts on them by leading us to cross paths with new ideas, other people, and necessary materials to build them out in form. Affirmation. I feel the presence as perfection, love, and goodness, making my life whole and complete. And from the Daily Word, published by Unity, Discover. As I discover, I learn and grow. My life is a journey of discovery. Over the years, I may have traveled to other lands, discovering new cultures and landscapes. Through my explorations, I've learned all kinds of things and grown in all kinds of ways. My spiritual life has been a journey of discovery as well. Through my spiritual practice, I've deepened in my understanding of God, of spirit, of the universe, and of myself as a spiritual being. I have discovered new landscapes within myself as I have communed with God in prayer and have changed my life through the power of my thinking. As long as I live, I will find more to discover. Questioning, learning, and growing help me discover the wonders within and all around me. World peace. I join those who are working toward a peaceful world. When I take in the news of the day, my heart may feel heavy and my mind troubled. An antidote to these feelings is the awareness that there are good-hearted people all over the world who are working toward peace. Acts of selfless service, compassion, and harmonious interactions are happening even in the midst of conflict and turmoil. Knowing this, I feel hopeful. Actually, joining those efforts can fill me with feelings of positivity and purpose. This weary world hungers for peace. I contribute to building it through prayer and other positive action. I need not bear the burden alone. As more and more people lend their hearts and hands in service, peace will spread to every corner of the earth. And from Mark Nepos, The Book of Awakening, Living the Life You Want by Being Present to the Life You Have, to affirm our person. Wisdom tells me I am nothing. Love tells me I am everything. And between the two, my life flows. Nisargadatta Maharaj. Having survived the inhumanity of the Holocaust and the death of her husband, Dr. Elkanan Elkas, the revered elder of the Kovno ghetto in Lithuania, Miriam Elkas told her son years later of two objects that sustained her. One was a piece of bread, which she always hid about her person, the other a broken piece of comb. She kept the bread in case someone needed it more than she, and no matter what, morning and night, she would comb her hair to affirm her person. What Miriam Elkes carried and how she used what she carried is a profound example of how the spirit can turn ordinary objects into living symbols that can help us live. For what she carried, the bit of bread and her broken comb, and why she carried them, speaks to the wisdom of love itself and makes me ask, what small thing do we each carry that we can give to others more in need than we, and what constant gesture do we each carry by which we can affirm our person? To carry these questions alone is life-sustaining. For to carry the smallest crust of bread or truth that we can offer others always reminds us of two essential facts, that we do not live this life alone, and that no matter the severity of our own circumstance, we have something to give to others. The fact of this does not invalidate our pain, but affirms our worth, that even in pain, we can be of value. We all live somewhere between nothing and everything. And to reenact along the way, the smallest gesture of valuing your life is to carry out God's, spirit's, the universe's work. Only by affirming our person can the human stalk of spirit break ground and grow into something free. Center yourself and breathe your way to the spirit's pause that waits beneath whatever hardship you may be facing. As you breathe slowly, let your heart bring to your awareness what small thing you have that you can offer others more in need than you. As you breathe freely, let your spirit give your body a gesture by which you can affirm your person. Breathe in and affirm your person. Breathe out and offer your gifts to the world. We return to Science of Mind and Reverend Dr. Jesse Jennings' monthly column and the question, no distance between you and spirit. I'm trying to come up with ways to define the relationship with or in God that don't scream duality, and it isn't easy. Answer, no, it sure isn't. To successfully define something, we have to view it objectively, and to accomplish that, we have to be separate from it. I can describe and define the lamp across the room because it's across the room, and I am not that lamp. I can define a sunset because it's there, and I'm here, with both my objective observance and subjective appreciation of it. If I go on to write a poem about sunsets, others will bring to their reading their own associations from prior experience. Evaluation has to precede definition, and again, all of that is made possible by distance. But there is no distance between ourselves and spirit, so we can't define spirit, though many have tried. We can only measure how we feel and describe that. Still, sometimes we're asked, what about spirit? And we have to say something. So here's where I go with it. We are of like nature, which I got from Ernest Holmes, who says, your relationship to life is that you are of like nature to it. You are in it, and it is in you. By life with the capital L, he means God, spirit, or higher power. This is in the same book as referenced above, originally published as This Thing Called Life, and now titled The Art of Life. Elsewhere, he tells us that we are surrounded by and immersed in the divine nature, but even that can feel separate and dualistic, since it sounds like we're not made of the same stuff as whatever is doing the surrounding and immersing. Rather than trying to nail down verbally the interplay between the human and the divine, you might explore metaphors, the way Jesus taught in parables and Da Vinci caught the light. Notice and elevate the part of yourself that loves beauty, harmony, and wonder, that loves love, which no one can define either. And from the same issue, we turn to an article by Ernest Holmes, How God Meets Your Needs. Friends, we are familiar with the expression that all things are possible to God, to spirit, to the universe. We believe there is a power greater than we are, a power that knows how to and can and will meet all our needs. And we all have needs that we would like to see met. There's nothing wrong with wishing to be happy or well or prosperous, and there is no harm in wanting people to like us. We certainly have a need both to love and be loved. If we believe there is a power that can meet all our needs, suppose we turn the proposition around in another way and ask this: why shouldn't these needs be met? Why shouldn't God do it? This will at least give us a new approach to the possibility of faith and a new light on how to use it. Of course, you and I know we do not coerce God, nor can we misuse the laws of nature. But we also know that when we use nature's laws rightly, they're always ready and willing to comply with us. It is true that the laws of nature obey us when we first obey them. Every advance in science, everything that has given modern life the luxury and freedom we enjoy, everything in the way of inventive genius, and what we call the modern way of living, all of these are the result of first learning how the laws of nature work and then complying with them so that even nature produces more for us when we cooperate with and know how to use nature's laws. All of our inner conflicts are a result of a violation of the natural law of our being. No patient ever came to a psychologist or a physician whose illness did not rise out of some violation at some point of a natural law. This is why we say that disease is unnatural, whether it be physical or emotional or mental. Using the laws of mind and spirit. Let's ask ourselves some other questions, for perhaps we have made a great big mistake. Too often we are unhappy and mentally not whole. Too often we lack the good things in life. And is it going too far to say that too often we are burdened with physical diseases that need never have been? Let's consider some other laws that are natural to us, the laws of mind and spirit, and why shouldn't we inquire into them and find out how they work and learn to comply with them with this definite end in view that we shall live fuller and happier lives? But of course, before we can use these laws of mind and these laws of spirit, we must believe they really exist and that we are supposed to use them. Now, this introduces a new idea and one that we're not all too familiar with. We think of the laws of mind and spirit too often as something beyond or outside the realm of nature. Often in our sincere desire to do right and to be right, we're a little afraid of the thought that we are rooted in pure spirit and can actually draw on a divine power and use it for a definite purpose. We limit ourselves all too often by thinking that nature's laws extend only as far as we can see. Always the laws of nature existed universally. We couldn't say our horizon is the end of space just because it is as far as we can see. There are unlimited horizons. As we begin to move toward our present horizon, we discover that it moves back and keeps moving back as we move forward. What we all need is the courage to keep moving into new horizons. Explorers in an adventure of faith. You and I happen to be explorers in an adventure of faith in the invisible. We believe all things are possible to God, to spirit, to the universe, who intends us to be whole and happy. We are just beginning to learn that the laws of mind and spirit are real, that they can be used for definite purposes, and we found a key to the use of these laws. The key is faith. This isn't a new idea. Thousands of years ago, it was stated, "As a man thinketh in his heart, so is he." Jesus said, "As you believe, so it is done unto you." This is why, even though a person might be afflicted with a physical illness, we advise reaching beyond the present condition and believing in perfect health. Our beliefs direct the power of good, but we do not have this kind of belief by accident. Each and every one of our beliefs is informed by previous experience until it becomes a habit of thought. And because this is true, we see the possibility of changing our old beliefs and forming new ones until they too become a habit of thought. This is what we mean by scientific prayer and by affirmative meditation. For of course, our prayers and meditations do not really change the divine nature. They merely put us in a position to better use it. How we use the law of good. Let's consider just how we should use this law of good and just see what it is that might be obstructing its flow through us. In doing this, the first things we come up against are the habits of thought we have had for so many years, thoughts that deny the possibility of the good we wish to experience, as though something arises from within our own minds that says something like this, "It's too good to be true. Nothing good could happen to me. I don't understand how to use this law. I am not good enough to use it." It is no wonder the Bible said that our enemies shall be those of our own households. But here is a blessing in disguise. For if our real enemies are our own thoughts, we at least have located them, and we now know just what they are and how they work and how to change them. Yes, the very fear we have had can be converted into faith. The misuse of the law of life that produced bondage can as easily bring about our freedom. We must know that it not only can, it will. The first thing we have to learn, then, is to convert every negative attitude into a positive one, every fear into a faith, every uncertainty into assurance. There is nothing difficult to understand about this. Rather, it is its very simplicity that eludes us. In actual practice, we take a few simple statements and think about them until they're real to us. For instance, let's say that when we awake in the morning, we do so with this thought, "This is the day that God has made, and I am going to be glad in it." And then, if the thought comes up that says, "Well, after all, you haven't very much reason to be glad," right here is where we must be on the alert. We must say to ourselves, "Yesterday is gone forever. This is a new day." If you do this, you will soon discover that when a negative thought comes up, by flatly denying it, you remove its power. When you affirm its opposite, you not only build up a resistance to the negative thought, you actually convert it into a positive power. For you see, fear and faith are but two ways of thinking. Each uses the same power. So you're not fighting an adversary. All you are doing is rearranging your thoughts. And when the thought comes and says, "What reason have I to suppose that I could be happy and whole today?" just take your mind right back to the idea that you are one with God, with Spirit, with the universe, one with all the life and presence and power there is, and affirm that God in you is happy. These are thoughts about the kingdom of God, and it is this kingdom alone that can free us from our fear and set us safe on a new life and a new light. Meditation. Let us take as a thought for our meditation today these words of Jesus, "With God, all things are possible." Let us see if we can make these words real to us as we quietly affirm, "I am now established in infinite life. My mind and my heart are open to the infinite good. I have no fear or doubt that can in any way turn aside or reject the blessing the Father has for me. The harmony of God brings me into peace with everything. The abundance of God prospers me in all I do. The beauty of God brings beauty into my life. I know the presence of God, which fills my mind, blesses everyone I meet. The quiet power of peace within me touches the heart of everyone I meet, bringing to all an assurance and a renewed faith in God." And at this point, I just want to take a moment again to remind all of you to please substitute whatever word works for you that you believe in, the higher power, the universe, Spirit, and it all really comes down to the same thing. From the same issue, we go to Reverend Dr. David Alexander's monthly column, Philosophy in Action, A Closer View of God. In this month's article from our founder, Dr. Ernest Holmes, he talks about something central to our teaching and central to all forms of religion, prayer. Prayer is nothing more than the language we use to communicate with the divine. Holmes and those whose shoulders he stood on in the New Thought movement sought to make prayer affirmative, direct and effective, yet such effort did not originate within New Thought. Holmes understood that Jesus also sought to make prayer more effective. Jesus told his disciples that his burden was light and his yoke was easy. As a rabbinical teacher, the method or interpretation of their teaching is considered the yoke of that teacher. So what he was really saying is that the lessons he was teaching are not complicated or difficult. They are easy to understand and comprehend. And a major theme in his teachings was about one's relationship to the divine, which is expressed through prayer. Jesus used the word Abba, which is a close and intimate form of Father, to define his relationship with the divine. Further, he taught that God's kingdom was at hand, nearer than our breath, and dwelling within us. Therefore, prayer was to be intimate, personal, and direct. You see, if God is not a far-off being of judgment, then prayer does not require supplication, beseeching, and begging. If God is close, intimate, personal, and loving, then prayer or communion with that divine presence can and should be affirmative, expressing our heart's desires. Holmes states in The Science of Mind that all prayers are effective that embody certain universal principles. This simply means that you have the ability to develop a language and communication pathway that accesses all the wisdom, power, and potentiality of the universe. In fact, whether you know it or not, you already have this language, regardless of whether or not you call it prayer. It is how you talk to your higher self. It is your internal self-talk. The universal power within you will respond to your self-talk by bringing into form that which you affirm. Make your self-talk a practice of positive language that speaks and declares your deepest desire. Can you talk to God? In so many ways, you already are. Travel well. We turn now to the September-October 2025 issue of Spirituality and Health, a Unity publication, and an article by Karen Brailsford, How to Make Fear Your Ally. Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. discusses teachings from his new book, The Poisoned Arrow. While holding his then-newborn son in what should have been a blissful moment, Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. suddenly and inexplicably became overwhelmed by dread. The term sudden infant death syndrome entered his mind, and immediately his body responded with terror. The only thing that changed in that room was a thought, he remembers. My whole body felt it. My emotion was real. What triggered it was not. More recently, during routine lab work following a concussion, Ruiz says his doctors discovered anomalies in his blood work and suspected chronic lymphomic leukemia. For nearly 2 months, he was left to live with the uncertainty as he waited for an appointment with an oncologist. The mind can go really crazy, he admits, describing how his thoughts spiraled through worst-case scenarios. Ultimately, the diagnosis turned out to be monoclonal B-cell lymphocytosis, a condition that can precede CLL but is not cancer itself and required him to make diet and lifestyle changes. In his latest book, The Poisoned Arrow, A Toltec Guide to Overcoming Fear, Ruiz offers a deeply personal and transformative exploration of these kinds of fears, those not based in reality but in the psychological. The Toltec approach, which he learned from his father, Don Miguel Ruiz Sr., author of The Four Agreements, and grandmother, Madre Sarita, a faith healer, offers a path to acknowledge and release these fears rather than be controlled by them. Beyond demonstrating how to overcome such fears, the poisoned arrow unearths where they come from and why we have them to begin with, the effects of fear. Ruiz emphasizes that fear is a natural, even essential, emotion. It is part of our biological survival mechanism, the fight, flight, or freeze response that protects us in moments of true danger. He recounts how fear has helped humanity survive for generations, alerting us to threats and mobilizing our bodies to act. However, the challenge arises when fear becomes untethered from immediate danger and begins to dominate our internal dialogue. To describe this inner chaos, Ruiz draws upon the Toltec concept of the mitote, a thousand voices clamoring in the mind. He likens it to sitting in a packed stadium where every voice is a thought or belief trying to get us to notice it. The mitote describes a thousand voices all hooking your attention, he says. So the question is, what are you giving your attention to? Fear in this setting often emerges from irrational beliefs, projections of what could go wrong, distorted by past trauma, conditioning, and ego. When we give these voices our attention, they become our reality, even if there is no real danger. Psychological fear is the root cause of all greed, envy, gossip, anger, and virtually every harmful action humans take against one another and the planet, he writes. This kind of fear corrodes our relationships, our communities, and even our stewardship of the earth. Recognizing this widespread influence is a call to action, and Ruiz is clear about where the work must begin, within. In order to change the world, we must be willing to look within and change ourselves, he writes. In fact, we cannot change others. The distinction between real fear and irrational fear is the cornerstone of Ruiz's teaching. Real fear serves us. Irrational fear enslaves us. He illustrates this with the example of watching a horror movie. Though we're physically safe, our minds react as if we are in danger, triggering the same biological responses. In life, we do the same thing. We imagine worst-case scenarios, respond with anxiety, and behave as if these imagined threats are real. The fear is real because the hormones triggered in the fight-or-flight response or the freeze response are real, he explains. We're experiencing it. It's happening. The body is going through it, but what triggered it may not be real. Changing our relationship with fear. This insight leads to one of the most empowering lessons in The Poisoned Arrow. We have a choice. While we cannot eliminate fear from our lives, we can choose how we engage with it. Ruiz stresses that acknowledging fear, honoring it without judgment, is the first step toward healing. Facing fear is actually acknowledging it and honoring, "This is how I feel," he says. Ruiz also explores how fear often disguises itself as control. We attempt to manage fear by trying to control outcomes, situations, and people, especially those we love. As a parent, he reflects on how difficult it is to let go, to trust that his son and daughter will find their own way. Yet he asserts that true trust and love require relinquishing control. Holding on too tightly, he warns, is simply fear masquerading as protection. The more you try to control, the less control you have, he says. The only thing I have control over is my choices. He further encourages readers to trust in their own ability to meet life with courage and purpose. Fear is always telling us to settle for less, but trust allows us to pursue the aspirations and take the actions that lead to a truly meaningful life, he writes. This realization is especially resonant for those navigating relationships. Fear shows up as jealousy, insecurity, judgment, or the need to dominate. But as Ruiz explains, these are not expressions of love. They are expressions of fear. The antidote is awareness, choosing each day to act not from fear, but from love. The Poisoned Arrow is not just a conceptual guide, but a practical one. Ruiz includes exercises and reflections designed to help readers identify their fears, trace their origins, and begin the process of letting go. One writing prompt invites readers to ponder when your mitote gets riled up with fear. What do the loudest voices say? In another exercise, readers are invited to think of an experience they usually associate with unpleasantness, such as discussing a sensitive topic with a family member. They're then tasked with treating it as an opportunity and considering the most positive outcome. Bathe this experience in love, he writes. With an exercise called The Thoughts Versus Facts, Ruiz instructs readers to draw a line down the middle of a page and jot down on one side all of the fantasies, speculations, and stories they can conjure up about a situation. On the other side, the bare facts. Seeing a situation in black and white helps us focus on the facts. In a world increasingly gripped by anxiety, division, and uncertainty, Ruiz's teachings provide a timely and timeless antidote. Ultimately, The Poisoned Arrow offers a liberating reframing of fear. Rather than trying to eliminate fear or pretend it doesn't exist, Ruiz encourages us to listen to it, understand it, and learn from it. It is through this process that fear becomes an ally, a signal that we are alive, aware, and on the edge of transformation. We heal with our own permission, and usually our permission comes when we're ready, he says. By recognizing the poison of fear within our wounds and then choosing to remove it with awareness and love, we return to ourselves. Our fear is not an end point, but a jumping off point for unimaginable growth, he writes. Learn to see your fear as the seed of something incredible, and you will unlock the secret of life. We pause for a moment to remind you that you're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona, 24 hours of programming from over 300 publications, and you're currently listening to the Philosopher Program with your host, Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Candy Lewis. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. We return now to the Book of Joy. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, with Douglas Abrams. And last week we had just started a section called Have You Renounced Pleasure? Science has a term for the unsatisfactory nature of pursuing pleasure alone, the hedonic treadmill, named for the Greek school of thought that believed pleasure to be the ultimate good. Throughout history, hedonism has had its advocates, back to the birth of written culture. In the Gilgamesh tale, Siduri, the female divinity of fermentation, in other words, alcohol, admonishes, "Fill your belly, day and night make merry. Let days be full of joy. Dance and make music, day and night. These things alone are the concern of men." Even in the deeply spiritual culture of ancient India, the source of much of the Dalai Lama's Tibetan tradition, there was a hedonistic school known as Charvaka. In many ways, hedonism is the default philosophy of most people, and certainly has become the dominant view of consumer shop-till-you-drop culture. Yet scientists have found that the more we experience any pleasure, the more we become numb to its effects and take its pleasures for granted. The first bowl of ice cream is sublime, the second bowl tasty, and the third causes indigestion. It is like a drug that must be taken in ever greater quantities to produce the same high. But there does seem to be one thing in the literature that powerfully and lastingly changes our sense of well-being. It is what the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop had been advocating throughout our first day, our relationships, and specifically our expression of love and generosity to others in our life. Richard Davidson, the neuroscientist with whom I had lunch in San Francisco, has drawn together the neuroimagining research into a unified theory of the happy brain. I was so fascinated by what he was saying that I could not pay attention to my spring rolls, and those spring rolls were really good, at least on the physical level. There are four independent brain circuits that influence our lasting well-being, Davidson explained. The first is our ability to maintain positive states. It makes sense that the ability to maintain positive states or positive emotions would directly impact one's ability to experience happiness. These two great spiritual leaders were saying that the fastest way to this state is to start with love and compassion. The second circuit is responsible for our ability to recover from negative states. What was most fascinating to me was that these circuits were totally independent. One could be good at maintaining positive states, but easily fall into an abyss of a negative state from which one had a hard time recovering. That explained a lot in my life. The third circuit, also independent but essential to the others, is our ability to focus and avoid mind wandering. And this, of course, was the circuit that so much of meditation exists to develop. Whether it was focusing on one's breath or a mantra or the analytic meditation that the Dalai Lama did each morning, this ability to focus one's attention was fundamental. The fourth and final circuit is our ability to be generous. That was amazing to me, that we had an entire brain circuit, one of four, devoted to generosity. It is no wonder that our brains feel so good when we help others, or are helped by others, or even witness others being helped, which Ekman had described as the elevation that is one dimension of joy. There was strong and compelling research that we come factory equipped for cooperation, compassion, and generosity. John Barg, one of the world's leading experts on the science of the unconscious, describes it as one of three innate, and often unconscious, goals: to survive, to reproduce, and to cooperate. In lab experiments where 18-month-old children were shown dolls facing each other, they were more cooperative than those who were shown dolls who were facing away from each other. This unconscious prime, which can be turned on or off, Barg argues, is one interesting example that cooperation is a deep evolutionary drive that exists from our earliest development. Perhaps more sobering, it has also hardwired us to cooperate with and be kind to those who look like our caregivers, who presumably kept us safe. We are more wary of others who look different. These are the unconscious roots of prejudice. Our empathy does not seem to extend to those who are outside our group, which is perhaps why the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama are constantly reminding us that we are, in fact, one group, humanity. Nonetheless, the ability and desire to cooperate and to be generous to others is there in our neural circuits, and it can be harnessed personally, socially, and globally. Our greatest joy. I address the next question to the Archbishop. The joy that you're talking about is not just a feeling. It's not something that just comes and goes. It's something much more profound. And it sounds like what you're saying is that joy is a way of approaching the world. Many people are waiting for happiness or joy. When they get a job, when they fall in love, when they get rich, then they will be happy. Then they will have joy. You are talking about something that is available right now without waiting for anything. The Archbishop considered his response carefully. I mean simply to say that ultimately our greatest joy is when we seek to do good for others. Was it really that straightforward? Did we just need to stimulate and satisfy our dedicated brain circuit of generosity? As if anticipating my skepticism, the Archbishop continued, It's how we are made. I mean, we're wired to be compassionate. Quite literally wired, I thought, based on Davidson's research. We are wired to be caring for the other and generous to one another. We shrivel when we are not able to interact. I mean, that is part of the reason why solitary confinement is such a horrendous punishment. We depend on the other in order for us to be fully who we are. I didn't know that I was going to come so soon to the concept that we have at home, the concept of Ubuntu. It says, a person is a person through other persons. Ubuntu says, when I have a small piece of bread, it is for my benefit that I share it with you. Because after all, none of us came into the world on our own. We needed two people to bring us into the world. And the Bible that we Jews and Christians share tells a beautiful story. God says, it is not good for Adam to be alone. Well, you could have said, no, I'm sorry, he's not alone. I mean, there are trees, there are animals, and there are the birds. How can you say he's alone? And you realize that in a very real sense, we're meant for a very profound complementarity. It is the nature of things. You don't have to be a believer in anything. I mean, I could not speak as I am speaking without having learned it from other human beings. I could not walk as a human being. I could not think as a human being except through learning it from other human beings. I learned to be a human being from other human beings. We belong in this delicate network. It is actually quite profound. Unfortunately, in our world, we tend to be blind to our connection until times of great disaster. We find we start caring about people in Timbuktu whom we've never met and we're probably never going to meet this side of death. And yet we pour out our hearts. We give resources to help them because we realize that we are bound up together. We are bound up and can be human only together. I was deeply moved by what the Archbishop was saying, yet I could hear the skepticism that some readers would have that I had had. Most people do not walk around thinking about how they can help others. Whether we like it or not, most people are waking up in the morning wondering how they're going to manage to do their job, make enough money to pay the bills, and take care of their families and other responsibilities. Nice guys finish last is a phrase that speaks to our deep ambivalence about kindness and compassion in the West. Success in our society is measured by money, power, fame, and influence. These men had all of these except the first, but neither would go hungry. For spiritual leaders, ignoring money was fine, but what about for those who lived and died in the almighty marketplace? Most people are not aspiring to spiritual greatness or enlightenment, but to pay for their children's education and make it through retirement without running out of money. I chuckled at the memory of visiting the house of some friends outside of Las Vegas. It was a beautiful home, actually more like a Persian estate, with multiple buildings, with fountains and flowing channels of water. It was reminiscent of the great structures of Islamic civilization. I was there for a discussion of the Archbishop's legacy, and when he arrived and witnessed the beauty and grandeur of the place, he had smiled and said cheekily, "I was wrong. I do want to be rich." As you just mentioned, the Dalai Lama added, getting quite animated, people think about money or fame or power. From the point of view of one's own personal happiness, these are short-sighted. The reality, as the Archbishop mentioned, is that human beings are social animals. One individual, no matter how powerful, how clever, cannot survive without other human beings. So the best way to fulfill your wishes, to reach your goals, is to help others, to make more friends. How do we create more friends? He now asked rhetorically. Trust. How do you develop trust? It's simple. You show your generous sense of concern for their well-being. Then trust will come. But if behind an artificial smile or a big banquet is a self-centered attitude deep inside of you, then there will never be trust. If you are thinking how to exploit, how to take advantage of them, then you can never develop trust in others. Without trust, there is no friendship. We human beings are social animals, as we've said, and we need friends. Genuine friends. Friends for money, friends for power, are artificial friends. The Archbishop jumped in. This God is community, fellowship. Being created by this God, we are created in order to flourish, and we flourish in community. When we become self-centered, turning in on ourselves as sure as anything, we are going to find one day a deep, deep, deep frustration. We are left with a paradox. If one of the fundamental secrets of joy is going beyond our own self-centeredness, then is it foolish selfishness, as the Dalai Lama would say, and self-defeating to focus on our own joy and happiness? The Archbishop had already said that we could not pursue joy and happiness in their own right, so is it not a mistake to focus on them at all? Research suggests that cultivating your own joy and happiness has benefits not just for you, but also for others in your life. When we are able to move beyond our own pain and suffering, we are more available to others. Pain causes us to be extremely self-focused. Whether the pain is physical or mental, it seems to consume all of our focus and leave very little attention for others. In his book with the Dalai Lama, psychiatrist Howard Cutler summarized these findings. In fact, survey after survey has shown that it is unhappy people who tend to be most self-focused and are socially withdrawn, brooding, and even antagonistic. Happy people, in contrast, are generally found to be more sociable, flexible, and creative, and are able to tolerate life's daily frustrations more easily than unhappy people. And most important, they are found to be more loving and forgiving than unhappy people. Still, some might wonder what our own joy has to do with countering injustice and inequality. What does our happiness have to do with addressing the suffering of the world? In short, the more we heal our own pain, the more we can turn to the pain of others. But in a surprising way, what the Archbishop and the Dalai Lama were saying is that the way we heal our own pain is actually by turning to the pain of others. It is a virtuous cycle. The more we turn toward others, the more joy we experience. And the more joy we experience, the more we can bring joy to others. The goal is not just to create joy for ourselves, but as the Archbishop poetically phrased it, to be a reservoir of joy, an oasis of peace, a pool of serenity that can ripple out to all those around you. As we will see, joy is in fact quite contagious, as is love, compassion, and generosity. So being more joyful is not just about having more fun. We're talking about a more empathic, more empowered, even more spiritual state of mind that is totally engaged with the world. When the Archbishop and I were working on creating a training course for peace ambassadors and activists who go into conflict regions, he explained how peace must come from within. We cannot bring peace if we do not have inner peace. Similarly, we cannot hope to make the world a better, happier place if we do not also aspire for this in our own lives. I was eager to hear about how we deal with the inevitable obstacles to joy, but I knew that would need to wait for the next day. There was time for only one brief question before lunch. I asked the Dalai Lama what it was like to wake up with joy, and he shared his experience each morning. I think if you are an intensely religious believer, as soon as you wake up, you thank God for another day, and you try to do God's will. For a non-theist like myself, but who is a Buddhist, as soon as I wake up, I remember Buddha's teaching, the importance of kindness and compassion, wishing something good for others, or at least to reduce their suffering. Then I remember that everything is interrelated, the teaching of interdependence. So then I set my intention for the day, that this day should be meaningful. Meaningful means, if possible, serve and help others. If not possible, then at least not to harm others. That's a meaningful day. Lunch. The meeting of two mischievous people is wonderful. And there's a delightful image of the two of them hugging each other head to head. The Dalai Lama's audience room had been transformed into a dining room. At the far end was an ornate golden Buddha encased in a colorful wooden box. The walls were hung with thangkas, brightly painted silk scrolls that depicted images of the Buddha and other Buddhist figures. They were traditionally hung on the walls of monasteries for brief periods of time to inspire meditative practice. They were used to encourage practitioners along the path of enlightenment. The windows were covered with white lace curtains, and the table was set for lunch with baskets of Tibetan flatbread and boxed juice containers. The whole setting was simple, almost like a picnic, and the meal was typical Tibetan food from the Dalai Lama's kitchen. There were noodles and vegetables and momos, the famed Tibetan steamed dumplings. The Dalai Lama and the Archbishop Tutu sat across from each other. As I sat next to the Dalai Lama, I could feel in his posture and his body language the power of a leader. I remembered how strongly and tenderly he had held my hand the first time we met. His kindness did not in any way diminish his power, a valuable reminder that compassion is a feature of strength, not weakness, a point they would make throughout our conversations. When the Dalai Lama greets you, he takes your hand and then rubs it tenderly as a grandparent might. He looks into your eyes, feels deeply what you are feeling, and touches his forehead to yours. Whatever feeling, elation or anguish, is in your heart and reflected on your face, it is mirrored in his. But then when he meets the next person, those emotions are gone, and he is wholly available for the next encounter and the next moment. Perhaps that is what it means to be fully present, available for each moment and each person we encounter, untethered by the ruminating memories of the past, and not lured by the anticipatory worry about the future. The lunch began by returning to the theme of birthdays, aging, and mortality. I went to see a German specialist for knees, the Dalai Lama said. He found my physical condition very good, and then he told me my knees were the problem. He said, you are not 18 years old, but 80 years old, so nothing much can be done. I really felt that was a great teaching. It is very important to think about impermanence. He reminds me, I'm 80 years old. That's wonderful. But, my friend, you are even older than me. Are you showing off? The Archbishop said. My own kitchen made this, the Dalai Lama said as he offered a piece of bread to his honored guest. You put your fingers on the bread and think I should eat it? Archbishop responded. I like this one, Archbishop Tutu said, passing over the multigrain for the white bread, glancing over at his American doctor with a smile. The media at the airport said, you must be very happy to have Archbishop Tutu visiting, the Dalai Lama said. I told them, yes, indeed, I am very happy. I am receiving one of my very good friends. Firstly, on the human level, he is a very good human being. Secondly, he is a religious leader, a serious practitioner who respects different religious traditions. Then thirdly, and most importantly, he is my very, very close friend. You are just flattering me. So then I told him that you often used to describe me as a mischievous person, and so I said, I also consider you a mischievous person. The meeting of two mischievous people is wonderful. So very happy reunion. They both laughed. Now the Archbishop crossed himself and said a prayer before eating his bread. Is it okay? Temperature is okay? The Dalai Lama asked. It did not matter that he was a great spiritual leader, the former head of the Tibetan nation, and the reincarnation of the Bodhisattva of compassion to the devout. At this moment, he was the host, and he was concerned with whether his guests were happy with the meal. Thank you very much, the Archbishop said. Thank you for welcoming us, and thank you for the lunch, and thank you for putting all those people along the road to welcome us. He laughed. The soup is delicious. I've never seen Archbishop Tutu miss an opportunity to thank someone or appreciate what he has been given. He will often stop an entire production or an event to acknowledge all that are present. The soup is beautiful, the Archbishop said, fending off the monks who were trying to serve him more food. Everyone else was almost through with their meals, and he was still sipping his soup. It's lovely. Please, please, this is all I'm going to have. I'm going later on to the dessert. I mean, the fruit salad. Then, seeing that ice cream was now being offered, he laughed. Yes, okay, maybe a little ice cream. He was swaying his head from side to side, balancing his health on the one side and his sweet tooth on the other. The Archbishop is a big fan of ice cream, especially rum raisin, and when he stayed with Rachel and me, his office kindly told us his food preferences, chicken instead of fish, rum and Coke, now given up for those pesky health reasons, and rum raisin ice cream. Rum raisin ice cream was not an easy flavor to find outside of the holidays, but we finally found a gallon container in the deep freezer of an ice cream warehouse. The Archbishop had three well-enjoyed bites for one dessert, and we ate the rest of the gallon for months. The conversation transitioned to the topics of bringing together their two religious traditions, the great challenge of religious conflict, and the need for tolerance. The Dalai Lama began by saying, "It's not possible for everyone to be a Christian or a Buddhist. There's no other choice but for followers of the world's religions to accept the reality of other faiths. We have to live together. In order to live happily, we must respect each other's traditions. I really admire other traditions." Kofi Annan, when he was in his last year, set up a commission, the Archbishop added. They called it the High Level Panel, a rather pompous title. We were from all traditions, and despite our diversity, we produced a unanimous report. We concluded there is nothing wrong with faiths. The problem is the faithful. That's true, the Dalai Lama agreed. I asked what we must do about intolerance and fanaticism, which was flaring all around the world. Education and wider contract are really the only solutions, the Dalai Lama replied. I have gone to make pilgrimages to holy sites all over the world, such as Fatima in Portugal, the Wailing Wall and Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem. One time I was in Barcelona, Spain, and I met a Christian monk who had spent 5 years in the mountains living as a hermit, with very few hot meals. I asked him what his practice was, and he said, the practice of love. When he answered, there was something very special in his eyes. This is really the practice at the core of all the world's religions, love. I didn't think to myself when I met this holy man, unfortunately he's not a Buddhist, or it's too bad he's a Christian. I often say to people, do you really think that, the archbishop began, but the Dalai Lama had turned to one of the monks who was serving food. The archbishop pretended to scold him. Are you listening? The Dalai Lama, who had missed the archbishop's comment, launched in with, so, that shows, really. The archbishop continued to pretend that he was offended. You see, he's not listening. Unless you use the stick, I will not listen, the Dalai Lama said, laughing. But I thought you were nonviolent. Now, please, you speak more. I should concentrate on eating. This is my last meal of the day. In the Buddhist monastic tradition, the Dalai Lama eats only 2 meals a day, breakfast and lunch. Okay, as I was saying, do you really think that when, I didn't say if, I said when, the Dalai Lama arrives in heaven, that God will say, oh, Dalai Lama, you've been so wonderful. What a pity you are not Christian. You'll have to go to the warmer place. Everybody sees just how entirely ridiculous it is. The archbishop paused and then in a very intimate moment of friendship said, I think one of the best things that ever happened to me was meeting you. The Dalai Lama smiled and then started to tell another story. I thought you were going to try to eat, the archbishop said. The Dalai Lama chortled and went back to his dessert. Yes, but you have been a wonderful influence in the world, the archbishop continued. There are many, many people that you have helped to become good people, and people of different religions, people of different faiths. They can see, they can sense, because I don't think it is what you say, although yes, what you say is okay. Sort of acceptable. Scientists also think you are clever, but it is really who you are. I think everywhere in the world you go, people are aware that you are authentic. You're not putting it on. You live what you teach, and you have helped very, very, very many people recover a belief in their faiths, a belief also in goodness. You are popular not just with old people, but also with young people. I've said that you and Nelson Mandela are the only people that I can think of who are not pop stars and who could fill Central Park as you do. I mean, when people know that you are going to come and speak, they come in droves. So the thing we say about our world being a secular world and all of that is only partly true. The Dalai Lama waved his hands, dismissing his rank or specialness. I always consider myself personally one of the 7 billion human beings, nothing special. So on that level, I have tried to make people aware that the ultimate source of happiness is simply a healthy body and a warm heart. As he spoke, I wondered, why is this so difficult for us to believe and to act on? It should be obvious that we are the same, but often we feel separate. There is so much isolation and alienation. Certainly, I had grown up feeling this way in New York City, which at the time was the most populated place in the world. Everybody wants a happy life, and our individual happy life depends on a happy humanity. So we have to think about humanity, discover a sense of oneness of all 7 billion human beings. Tea or coffee, the Dalai Lama said, once again returning from the spiritual teacher to the host. I've got juice, thank you, the archbishop replied. You were raised with a very special status in Tibet. You must have come to this recognition of oneness over time. Yes, I have grown in my wisdom from study and experience. When I first went to Peking, now Beijing, to meet Chinese leaders, and also in 1956 when I came to India and met some Indian leaders, there was too much formality, so I felt nervous. So now when I meet people, I do it on a human-to-human level. No need for formality. I really hate formality. When we are born, there is no formality. When we die, there is no formality. When we enter hospital, there is no formality. So formality is just artificial. It just creates additional barriers. So irrespective of our beliefs, we are all the same human beings. We all want a happy life. I couldn't help wondering if the Dalai Lama's dislike of formality had to do with having spent his childhood in a gilded cage. Was it only when you went into exile, I asked, that the formality ended? Yes, that's right. So sometimes I say, since I became a refugee, I have been liberated from the prison of formality. So I became much closer to reality. That's much better. I often tease my Japanese friends that there is too much formality in their cultural etiquette. Sometimes when we discuss something, they always respond like this. The Dalai Lama vigorously nodded his head. So whether they agree or disagree, I cannot tell. The worst thing is the formal lunches. I always tease them that the meal looks like decoration, not like food. Everything is very beautiful, but very small portions. I don't care about formality. So I ask them, more rice, more rice. Too much formality. Then you are left with a very little portion, which is maybe good for a bird. He was scooping up the last bits of dessert. Everybody may want to be happy, I offered, but the challenge is a lot of people don't know how. You were talking about the importance of being warm-hearted, but a lot of people are shy or have a hard time opening up to other people. They get scared. They're afraid of rejection. You've spoken about when you approach people with trust, then it inspires trust in them as well. That's right. Genuine friendship is entirely based on trust, the Dalai Lama explained. If you really feel a sense of concern for the well-being of others, then trust will come. That's the basis of friendship. We are social animals. We need friends. I think from the time of our birth till our death, friends are very important. Scientists have found that we need love to survive. Our mothers show tremendous love and affection to us when we are born. Many scientists say that after birth, there are a number of weeks when the mother's physical touch is the key factor to developing the brain properly. After birth, if the child is isolated without the mother or physical touch, it can be very harmful. This is nothing to do with religion. This is biology. We need love. The Dalai Lama had first heard about this research in the 1980s from the late biologist Robert Livingston, who later became his biology tutor. Child neurologist and neuroscientist Tali Baram has conducted one of the more recent examples of this important field of research, and she found that a mother's caress triggers activity that improves cognition and resilience to stress in a baby's developing brain. The mother's touch could literally prevent the release of stress hormones that have been shown to lead to the disintegration of dendritic spines, branch-like structures on the neurons that are important to the sending and receiving of messages and the encoding of memory. Well, we come now to the end of our program. We'll continue with this book in the coming weeks. As always, I wish you a beautiful, joyous, and peaceful new week, and I look forward to being with you next time on our Philosopher program.